Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. It is May 2nd, 2017, and I am Chris Martinson. I think there's an oil price shock coming in a few years. Now, today we're going to talk with one of the leading experts on oil and gas production in the U.S., and the person I trust most to analyze and tell the truth about the shale plays in particular. Now, here's why you should care a lot about this subject. There's simply no question that economic growth requires energy. Specifically, if you want more economic growth, then you are, by definition, going to consume more energy. That's what decades of data in the energy economic data series tells us. So, how much we have and whether or not it can support the necessary or even required economic growth to service the massive piles of debt we've got today, not to mention the un- and underfunded pension and entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. We're way past the time where prudent adults can simply wish or assume that somehow, some way, energy will magically show up to save our future hopes and dreams. And it's also past time to begin planning for a very different future of less. And that begins with a grounding in the base data. So that's what we're going to do today. And if you choose not to tune in, then you will be among those who cannot see what the future holds and will have to content yourself with whatever comes your way. So let me introduce today's guest, Arthur Berman. He's been on the show several times before. He's a geological consultant with nearly 40 years of experience in petroleum exploration and production, with 20 of those at Amoco, now known as BP. He has published more than 100 articles on geology, technology, and the petroleum industry during the past 5 years. He's got the chops and has published more than 20 articles and reports on the shale gas plays, including the Barnett, the Haynesville, Fayetteville, Marcellus, Bakken, Eagle Ford, and of course, Permian plays. I follow him very closely at his blog at artberman.com. You should too. Welcome, Art. It's great to have you back on.
Thanks, Chris. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, let's start it way on the outside of the story. You know, I feel like the U.S., Art, and possibly the world has taken its eye off the oil situation, except to note that everyone kind of seems to believe that oil is, well, it's oversupplied, the cost to extract it are dropping, there's lots of it, we can just find more as soon as we need to. First, is there any truth to that?
There's underlying truth to even the silliest things that we believe, or they wouldn't last. So, it's not a totally crazy idea. If price gets high enough, we will find oil and gas in some very strange and very expensive places. So, I'm not interested in spreading any kind of false ideas that we're running out of oil. We're not running out of oil. We're not running out of gas. The problem that we've had now for the past at least 20 years is that we seem to have run out of inexpensive oil and gas. And that's where the so-called shale plays, the offshore, deep water kinds of ventures that have dominated the industry now for much of the last 20 years come in. And so you can always find more. Question is, what does it cost? And that's, I think, an issue that we don't really want to talk about very much. And the second piece of that is the idea that somehow technology is always going to save us. And I think that theme goes way beyond oil and gas and energy, but it's certainly prevalent in my line of work, which is oil and gas. And so the problem there is that people seem to lose the distinction between technology and energy. Technology does not create energy. Technology is simply a way to convert energy or to convert resources into work. And so you can improve the technology, and basically it allows you to, turn the faucet on harder. It doesn't create any new energy. And it certainly doesn't help you conserve what you already have. In fact, quite the opposite. The better the technology, the quicker you run through what you have left. So those are, you know, so the themes that you're talking about, everything has a cost. And so many, many things are possible. Yeah, we can always find more oil and gas. Are we, you know, are we willing to pay for it? Is our global economy capable of managing that cost? That's really the issue.
Well, well said. And let me just echo something really quick. The thank you for saying the technology does not create energy. I think a lot of people have a mistaken faith in technology, assuming that it's technology that that allows us to get more energy. And maybe there's some truth to that. If we can get 12% out of a tight play instead of 10%, that extra 2%, it's kind of like extra energy the technology unlocked or our genius processes. But at the end of the day, it also allows us to get it out more rapidly. It doesn't create new energy. Really important point. So let me echo that. And then there's a lot to unpack in here. I started with this idea that I think oil prices are going to have to be a lot higher in the future. And here's why. Let's go to the cost side of this. I know that new finds in the deep water plays, in some of the more unconventional plays, tar sands, Orinoco Heavy Belt, Venezuela, these cost a lot of money to go out and do. And so just again, starting at the macro before we get down to the shale, you know, here's what kind of caught my eye, Art, is that oil discoveries measured in billions of barrels across the globe for 2014, 15, and now 16, when you add those 3 years together, I don't have a worse 3 years for oil discoveries in my data series, which only goes back to the 20s. We have individual years that are as bad as a couple of real dry years in the early 50s. But as a three-year set, this is the lowest discovery set we've got in many, many decades by my data. Tell people, like explain that to people. Why is that a concern?
There are really two pieces to that, to this answer, Chris. And the first is that we've been looking at diminishing returns as far as the size of what we've discovered now for, you know, the last 40 or 50 years, really. This was a trend that, you know, was of concern long before shale plays certainly came onto the horizon or the landscape. So it's kind of an endemic problem, and that's the reason that we went to things like tar sands. We went to things like ultra deep water. You know, we've gone to you know, to all sorts of exotic things because we're just not adding the reserves. And oil companies, particularly publicly traded traditional major oil companies, they, you know, a big measure of are they being successful, at least according to investors, is are they replacing the reserves that they're producing? And for a long time, that's been a real challenge for them. And so in some ways, the shale plays have been a little bit of an out that they've been able to, at least on paper, say they're adding reserves again, whereas in the past they weren't. So so that's, you know, that's part of the story. But the short term story is we're just not spending the money. Mm-hmm. Okay. We've had a collapse in oil prices. And, you know, you go from several years of $100 oil, let's just say as a round number, it was actually more than that for a while. And then you go to oil prices that average, you know, $45 or $50, and everybody tightens up and they got to cut back their spending on everything. And most particularly, What happens is that we look for this measure called return on capital. Okay, so if I got a dollar to spend, where can I not only get the biggest bang for my buck, but the quickest return? Because obviously getting your money back sooner than later is an important piece of time value of money and just basic economics. And the truth is that most of the larger discoveries that have been made any time in the last 30, 40, 50 years have all been in very difficult, expensive kinds of terrains that take years. sometimes a decade or more from discovery to first production, all kinds of cost overruns, et cetera, et cetera. Bottom line, lousy return on capital invested. Okay, so we come along with the, you know, the shale plays, and here's a way that we can spend a limited amount of money, drill a couple of wells onshore, relatively inexpensive compared to offshore platforms, and get a return, you know, get something back pretty quick. And so what's happened since prices collapsed is that the emphasis has shifted from these big long-term kind of projects that have many, many years before they start to even show any monetization, much less paying off your investment, to quick pops, things that we can do without committing a lot of capital to. We can start them, we can stop them, and we get a fairly quick return. That works great for the companies, or it works better than anything else, but it's not really great for long-term supply. So we're just not investing the money in the big stuff. That's the simple answer.
Not just the big stuff, but also I think in some of the trickier fields, the infill drilling and the other EOR, end of oil recovery sort of processes, steam injections, whatever. It seems like a lot of investment is just tailed off. And yes, the new investment is pouring into the shale because you have these quick returns and all of that. But it was the old conventional fields that we built our entire industrialized economy on. And these were the fields where you could stick a straw in the ground and that well might produce for many decades afterwards. So yes, there's a long lead time, but it creates a sort of like, I guess if the analogy here would be, the old conventional fields are sort of the base load generators in the electrical grid. And then the shale comes on as kind of like your gas-fired power plant. So it's like, you know, it gives you quick spurts and all of that. But is that fair characterization for me to think that there's been an underwhelming or even an under amount of investment in what we would call the baseload oil generation?
Well, that's exactly right. But here's the reason. It's not because we're ignoring it, and it's not because we're stupid. It's because we found all that. We found all the good stuff, all the easy stuff that was found decades ago. And that's, you know, going back to the first point I made when you asked the question about, you know, why are we having such lousy years for discovery? It's not a new problem. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we just don't know where there are more, you know, Saudi Arabia size, Prudhoe Bay, North Alaska size, you know, Cantarell, Mexico size fields. We if they're out there, we don't know where they are, and our technology doesn't allow us to see them. So, you know, in a way, it's like your base load is dwindling. You got to replace it with other stuff, or you're not going to have any power at all.
Well, indeed. So just to put it in context, let's round up. You know, there's 90 plus million barrels a day of liquids fuels on the market right now per day. Let's round up to 100. If we say that, again, to round, just to make this all easy, that there's 5% decline rates in the existing fields, that means you have to replace about 5 million barrels per day per year. To put this in context, how much shale oil are we getting out of the U.S., which has, you know, really been, I think, overbilled as this swing producer capable of ramping up at a moment's notice, you know, could really hit the shortfalls. If we were having to replace 5 million barrels a day per year out of existing baseload, to put shale in the U.S. in context, if you can, around that number.
Sure. So to use round numbers, the tight oil, if you will, the shale in the U.S. produces about 4.5 million barrels a day. Okay, so but that's a number that has to be continued. You got to keep drilling and drilling and drilling to even keep that number flat, much less growing. So, you know, you're talking about needing to add that amount every year. And that possibility, you know, trying to be realistic as opposed to pessimistic, it's just I don't see how you can do that. I don't think that the size of the resource is big enough, at least in the United States, to do that. So it's great. You found 4 or 5 million barrels a day that you didn't think you had. But can you do that every year? Absolutely not. We've kind of done it once. And the additions that we're making, although they're praised in the press, We're not in the most optimistic scenario. Maybe we're going to add 1 million barrels a day for a couple of years before all that goes away. So no, the world is in very bad shape when it comes to where might we find, forget about what we are finding, where might we find that 4 or 5 million barrels a day every year that we need? And shale is a piece of it, but it's not the answer.
Yeah, well said. And so that's really where I was getting to with this idea that I think there are higher oil prices in the future, and not least of which is that we know there's more offshore, we know there's more in the ultra deep water, we know how much it costs, we have some idea that there is more there, so obviously we'll go for more if we need to. But the prices will have to at least come up to, I would call it the marginal cost of production. But I mean, the prices have to come up higher than they are for a company to even say, yeah, that's worth it, let's go do that. So that's kind of my view, is that we're going to need more oil in the future, and it's going to have to come up to not the marginal cost of production of shale, but the marginal cost of production of those other marginal barrels that are out there, whatever else is in the world. I mean, is that a fair way to think about it, or is oil like just such a different commodity we can't think about it?
No, it's a commodity like all other commodities, and you're thinking about it exactly correctly. That's the way you have to think about it. And so what is that price? I mean, that and of course, nobody really knows the answer to that. But just to kind of, clear the garbage from the daily headlines, the idea I saw something this morning where the offshore technology conferences in Houston, where I live today, that's all the big deep water guys, and somebody at BP said, well, even though our break even cost in deep water is $40 a barrel, if prices go below 50, we're not going to drill. Okay, well, let's deconstruct that comment. When he says that the break-even price is $40 a barrel, what he means is that the production costs are $40 a barrel. Forget about, all the exploration. Forget about all the cost of building platforms and pipelines. When all of that cost is already spent, then the physical cost of just lifting and producing and paying taxes on the produced oil is $40 a barrel. That's a real different number than the marginal barrel you're talking about, Chris. I mean, the real number for the deep water is probably, at least $70 in a very optimistic scenario. So when he says they're not going to do any drilling in deep water, BP, who's a global leader in everything, but in deep water, and the price of oil today is not $50, kind of hard to be optimistic about that, isn't it?
Well, it is. And so this gets to a really important point. And you said clear the garbage from the headlines. And I feel like that's what we're doing here in the opening parts of this podcast is I in the United States, I have to deconstruct things that people have been reading, which I consider to be a little bit on the spin side, a little bit PR, sometimes overt propaganda, sometimes just flat out lies. So to help sort of bring some clarity to this, this idea of a break-even cost, you just mentioned, very important concept here, that when somebody says, here's the break-even cost of getting this barrel out of the ground, that might be what's included if all you're looking at is the well has already been drilled and you're just trying to get oil out of the ground. That's one way to look at it, the simplest. But we have to go wider than that. And what we really care about as investors in this space would be the all-in cost, which I believe people at these oil companies like to be paid salaries. I believe they have taxes that are due, severance taxes, income taxes. I believe that they've got royalties. They've got all kinds of things that are actually part of their operating structure. So when you mentioned, in things that we've read that some of these shale plays are able to break even at 20 a barrel or 30, somewhere in that zone, is that a break even number or is that an all in number?
No, that's a break even number. If you eliminate what you call sunk costs, okay, mm-hmm. Everything you had to pay to get to that, it's a point forward number, Chris. That's really what we're talking about. And while it does include some of those costs you mentioned. It never includes fundamental costs of doing business, like paying salaries and keeping the lights on and, running your corporate jets and things like that. And it also never includes your interest expense. And all mm-hmm. these companies, even the biggest, are in major debt, and interest expense is a big part of what they have to do to stay alive. So at the very least, it excludes those two huge components of just doing business. So it's not a real number.
Well, let's talk about that interest expense real quick. Let's see if I'm thinking about this the wrong way or the right way. Last I heard, there was about $350 billion in debt on the shale companies. And to put that in context, I know oil's trading in the high 40s today. But let's just, again, I love round numbers. So let's imagine that at the wellhead, they're getting $35 a barrel, right? And this is just so I can do the math in my head. If I divide 35 into 350, I get a number like 10. That means that the next, that they would have to extract 10 billion barrels just to pay the debt back without interest costs on top of that, without any shareholder return. I mean, is there another way to think about this business? I mean, to me, that's classic business 101. If they have $350 billion in debt and they're selling stuff for $35 a unit, they need 10 billion units just to clear out the debt before they begin to add to things like, oh, I don't know, shareholder equity or interest payments or any of the rest of that. Is that fair?
That's fair, and as you know, it's back of the envelope, and it's a little bit more complex than that. But if you're just trying to get a quick read on how we doing here, that's a great way to do it. And if that doesn't look good, then you need to dig deeper and find out what's really going on in the complexity of it all. And that's the reason I spend a lot of time looking at these annual reports that the Securities and Exchange Commission requires of publicly traded companies, even ones that aren't based in the U.S., because they're required to provide something called the standardized measure, which is, okay, given oil prices or gas prices, whichever you're dealing with today, what do you project to be your future cash flows? Mm-hmm. Just to produce those reserves that you've already proven. And what I'm seeing is that the cash flows that they're projecting and the reserves that correlate with them are about a third of what they were in 2014. Okay, so we can talk all about break-even costs getting lower all the time, but we're doing that by writing down huge reserves and projecting a whole lot less profit, if you will, for the companies and their shareholders. Now, there's just no way to spin that into a good thing that I know about. And fair enough, it's because prices are terrible, but that's the way it is. I mean, that's just the way business works. I mean, you have to live with what you have.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's turn on that for a minute, because now we're down in it. And you wrote an article recently that the headline of which is low break-even prices are not just for shale players, they're for everyone. Tell us about that and why that's important.
Well, the mythology, the headlines are that somehow these shale companies have shown us the end of history, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that now that we're doing shale, everything that you used to think was true about oil and gas, it's no longer true. Where we used to think we were running out of affordable oil and gas resources as recently as 10 years ago or so, forget about that. Now we got a cornucopia that never stops giving, and all those dinosaur companies like ExxonMobil and BP and whatever, they're just not nimble enough. They're not hip to all the nuances and technology. And so you really don't want to look at them anymore. You want to look at these very agile companies that are using all the new technology. Well, so I just went and looked at this data that I described, that the SEC requires of all these companies. And yeah, it's true. The shale companies are breaking even at $40 a barrel. And guess what? So are all the big companies, all right? And why is that? Well, first of all, these big companies aren't dumb. I mean, they're not just you know, sitting on the sidelines, like, you know, waiting to become extinct while the supposedly nimbler, smaller companies are kicking them in the butt. I mean, they're changing too. But the real answer is they're all writing down massive amounts of reserves and a whole bunch of costs that come along with those, you know, like equipment and depreciation. And so, you know, when they get to the bottom of all that crap and they dust it off, they say, hey, we're breaking even at $40 a barrel. Well, yeah, everybody is. It's nothing special. It's called hard times. And the most important piece of this is what's happened to the cost of doing business. And I'm talking about the oil field service companies, the companies that provide the drilling rigs, that provide the frack crews, that provide the drilling muds, that do that. They have had to discount their cost of services so severely that's the major component that's driving this so-called lower break-even price. That you go out and you can download a producer price index for the cost of drilling oil and gas wells from the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, and the cost of doing that has gone down like 40% in the last 2 years. No thanks to technology. That's just the discount that these companies have to provide to get some cash flow. And so the headline tells us it's all technology. And I'm not saying there's no technology, but in my post that you're talking about, I'm saying it's 10% technology and 90% cost reduction from the service providers. Now maybe that's a round number too, you know. I mean, I'm not going to dispute it. Is it 15, 85? I don't know what it is. But the huge component of this cost reduction is that the oil field service companies are going out of business. They can't continue to do business at these prices.
And when the inevitable turn comes, then the flip side of this story would be that the break-even cost will then, you know, shoot back up again, because the cost to drill and service will also be going back up. Is that right?
And absolutely. And if you go out to the St. Louis Fed and download that that oil and gas well drilling producer price index, you'll see that there's been a big jump in the last 2 months. Why? Because activity has gone up a lot because prices went up, and everybody is hopeful that the OPEC cuts are going to bring happy days again. So, yeah, the two always work in tandem. And as the service companies need to charge more and can charge more to stay alive, then the cost of a barrel of oil is going to go up. There's no way around it.
All right. So the shale story, really, you know, the headlines are just screaming constantly, technology, technology, technology. It is a component. Some of that is technology. Some I've noticed is process. Not to get too wonkish, but, you know, somebody sent me this thing and said, wow, look at the flow rates on this well. And when I looked at it, it was like instead of a 6,000 foot lateral, which is the horizontal part of the well down way down below, it was close to 11,000 or 12,000 feet. And instead of a 20 stage frack, it was a 100 stage frack. And there was 50 million pounds of sand put down that hole. So my first thought was, well, yeah, you basically drilled two wells or something like that. That feels like a process improvement, which is, I'm sure there's amazing technology. I don't want to diminish the skill involved, but I do want to say that that sounds like we're supersizing a process we already understood. And that to me feels like just a way of, I'm not sure that that's helping us get more out of the ground at a better price. I'm not clear on that. What are your thoughts there?
The question to ask always is, gee, guys, that's great. What does it cost? Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we have an important razor, I guess you'd call it. Are you actually producing new reserves, or is this a case of rate acceleration, that you're just accelerating what you would produce anyway without spending all that money and not drilling that 11 or 12,000 foot horizontal and not pumping all that sand in and all that kind of stuff? And I did a study, which I published on my website not very long ago, on the Bakken play in North Dakota, which is one of the three big components of of tight oil or shale oil in the United States. It's, you know, pretty nearly a million barrels a day. And what I discovered to my surprise, really to my surprise, because I've kind of liked that play as much as I like any of these plays, is that we're starting to see signs of depletion. Okay, that it looks to me like you know, we've overshot the limits of efficiency as far as infilling locations go. Does that mean that the Bakken is done? Well, no. I mean, it's going to continue to produce for a long, long time. But the likelihood of it increasing production very much, except by rate acceleration, is low. All right. Well, now that's a big wake-up call, because we've been led to believe that this tight oil resource is, you know, just, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And here's one of the three major legs to the stool in the United States. And 10 years in, and it's starting to show signs of losing its momentum. Now, why should that surprise anybody? I mean, these may be unconventional reservoirs, but the laws of Earth physics don't change for them. Mm-hmm. And there's hardly a field anywhere in the world, or a play anywhere in the world, that doesn't reach a peak and start to decline. And 10 years is you know, for a round number, is a pretty darn good number for when you've maxed out on growth and supply. And so, you know, so this came as a big surprise, and needless to say, I got a lot of criticism, not the least of which was from the, you know, the officials in North Dakota, who couldn't imagine, you know, who this, you know, this person was who dared to question the, you know, the, all of their good work. But I you know, the data is pretty clear, and really and truly, you know, nobody has come to me and said, well, Art, here's what you did wrong. And so what's that say? Well, that says that we're going to start seeing the same thing in these other plays. So and the thing that really worries me the most is water production. We never hear about water production, but water is not a useful component of, you know, gasoline or jet fuel or anything else. And yet it comes with the territory. You're going to produce a certain amount of water. You got to pay a lot of money to get rid of it. And what I saw in the Bakken is that water production was increasing in a big way. And we're not talking about a little bit of water. We're talking about billions of barrels of water along with billions of barrels of oil. And I go out and look at the Permian Basin, which is a much younger play, and the water cuts, the percentage of water as a, you know, as a percentage of the total oil plus water produced, is already 80-85%.
What? Really?
Really?
Wow.
Wow is right. Okay, so this is the dark side. So there are really two dark sides to the shale plays. The first we've talked about is that because of all the great technology, you're going to run through it faster than if you didn't have the great technology. The second is that because it's an unconventional accumulation, okay, it doesn't have a trap. It doesn't have a way to get above the water or to produce it more slowly so you don't pull the water in. It comes with the territory. There comes a point where you're just going to produce more water than you can pay for your operations. And I'm not trying to be a doomster here. I'm just, you know, this is my profession. And when I see 80% water cut early on in the life of a field or a play, I'm starting to say, wow, that's not a good thing.
Now, just to help people understand this, the Bakken rounding, the play is down about 10,000 feet. So as water starts to intrude and you're lifting, say, one barrel of water for every barrel of oil, you still have to lift that barrel of water 10,000 feet, right? It's got to come up a couple of miles. Is that, I mean, I assume there's an energy cost associated with lifting water, because when I carry pails of water upstairs, I get winded. So I'm assuming it doesn't come out of the ground for free, right? You got to lift it.
Well, that's a good point. And so at the risk of, you know, of getting deeper into the proverbial weeds here, with a shale reservoir, because it has no natural permeability, you don't just put it on a pump. like we do a conventional reservoir. Okay, we don't you fracture it artificially, and presumably if you put it on a pump, all you do would be to pull from the fractures that you've created. So you wouldn't actually be pumping from the storage, and so we rely on the gas that's dissolved in the oil to provide that heavy lifting that you're talking about when you mm-hmm. carry water. Okay, and what I saw in the Bakken is that the percentage of gas produced is declining. That means that the energy in the reservoir that's bringing the oil to the surface is going away. So you got you're decreasing the gas, which is a bad thing because that says that your energy's going down, and you're increasing the water, which is what you would expect. It's coming in to replace the volumes of gas and the lower volumes of oil that you're producing. So you put those two things together, and that's the reason that I had to write the post, which, you know, wasn't fun to write, and it wasn't optimistic.
Well, that is really shocking to me that this, you know, we're just 10 years in, and of course this sort of mirrors what we saw in some of the shale gas plays. The Barnett, I think, was a rounding again, but about 10, 12 years to peak. And again, prices play a role in this. So we have to keep lots of moving pieces in mind. I assume that if all of a sudden oil was 200 a barrel, lots of other areas in the Bakken would suddenly make sense. I assume they've been high grading, meaning there's sweet spots across this giant territory. Some are more rich in oil and gas and under higher pressure or whatever, however we're defining that, and others not as much. So what you found in the Bakken, I assume, is that in the areas where they've concentrated, they've kind of already hit, they've saturated. Like infill drilling is not going to really deliver more at this point in time. So what's left are all the sort of the suburbs, the poorer suburbs in this story that are just waiting for higher oil prices, I assume. And so we've got that as a component. But the idea that about 10 years in and you've kind of mapped it out and hit the sweet spots hard is sort of, it, you know, it, whether it's 10 or 20 years, Art, I'm just looking at the idea that these shale plays, we ought to be treating them for what they are. They're amazing, as you put it once, retirement parties. So let's throw a really good party, but they're gonna hit a peak and they're gonna run out at some point. And then, you know, then where are we in this story?
Well, you're exactly right. And back to the point I made a little while ago, that's what we would expect. I mean, that we've got 150 years of history of producing oil and gas wells and oil and gas fields around the world. And so far, I mean, I have not seen the laws of physics give unconventional or shale plays a pass on the laws of physics. And so there's just nothing unusual about the fact that you should expect to see things grow and get better and peak and decline. I mean, that's just the way that's the way that natural systems work. All natural systems, you know, my life, your life. I don't think I'm going to grow anymore. In fact, I'm getting old, and I expect my health to decline, and we all do, because that's our personal life. Why should an oil field be different than any other natural system? So you're right. The poorer suburbs, we can gentrify those mm-hmm. if the price is right. A higher price means we're going to go out and we're going to develop higher cost reserves in those shabbier suburbs. But like everything else, what does it cost, and what are we willing to pay for that additional fix of energy? And that's where I think you're going with this, Chris, is that unless we somehow figure out how to scale back our use of energy in the world, but we can just talk about the United States for now. There's a day of reckoning, which isn't that many years out, and nobody knows how many it is, where we're just not going to be able to do this anymore for $40 or $50 or $60 a barrel. And what are the implications of that?
Well, we saw some of the implications, I believe, in July of 2008 when oil spiked to 147 a barrel, and of course we had this giant financial crisis, and it bears repeating. there was, roughly speaking, around $150 trillion in debt on the world landscape at that point, and the oil prices slammed into that, took down places like Greece, Italy, Portugal, the so-called pigs of Europe, which are all 100% oil importers, hurt them. And now, if we hit a higher oil price, my prediction is, well, now we have about $250 trillion in debt on the books. It's a much, much different landscape. And so you said, what are we willing to pay? And I'm also asking, what can we actually afford, given where we are economically in the story? And maybe that's two sides of the same coin. Skipping ahead now, to go back to something you said, you talked OPEC really quickly. I would love to get OPEC on this podcast. I'm looking at the oil production here for the OPEC top 13 exporters. It really spiked up. They hit just a little over almost 33.4 million barrels a day. It's since come back to 32. So almost a million and a half barrels of production from that little spike, but generally at around the 32 level where OPEC's been producing. Is this any sign that the cuts are working, or that they're sticking to it, or is OPEC irrelevant? What's going on here now?
OPEC is far from irrelevant. The U.S. press would like you to believe that they're not as relevant as they used to be, but I promise you they are very relevant. And maybe what they're really talking about is OPEC is an unhappy family. Mm-hmm. And there are rich OPEC members and there are poor OPEC members, and they've all got, just like any dysfunctional family, they've got their issues. Okay, OPEC is not a united front. However, bottom line, I've got a graph on my latest post that actually shows production from OPEC plus Russia and Mexico, which are the two main countries that have joined with OPEC in this cut. And as far as I can tell, they have cut about the 1.8 million barrels a day of liquids that they said they were going to cut. Mm-hmm. And is that having an effect? Yes, it's having an effect. It has to have an effect. I mean, you can't cut 1.8 million out of 90 million barrels a day and have there be no effect. And we're seeing that inventories, the amount of oil in storage, certainly going down in outside the United States, and more lately, it's going down some in the United States. So, I mean, this is what we would expect. If you produce less, then there's going to be less supply, and eventually things are going to hopefully get back to what you'd like to call normal. The point that I make repeatedly, and I think all responsible analysts do, is we got a long way to go because we've stored up awful lot of oil over the last 2 or 3 years when prices were low, and you do that because it's cheaper to store it than it is to sell it, and so you store it hoping that you can sell it later for more money. That's just the way that the futures markets in commodities work. So with the cuts in place, assuming that they're working, and I'm saying I think they are based on the data that I have, when should we expect to see prices get back to something that that maybe would stimulate investment in some of these environments in deep water, for instance, where we need to spend money to develop future supply? And the number that's thown around a lot is $70 a barrel. I don't know if that's the right number, but let's use it for now. And so if we just look at, well, how much of this global inventory needs to be reduced to get there, assuming that the present will be like the past, we don't know that, but we'll assume that. At the very minimum, we're talking about 6 months or a year, very minimum. So this is not something that's going to occur quickly. And of course, there's a million caveats on that. Will all the members of OPEC be able to hang in there? Well, I don't know. What happens with all the U.S. shale producers that are going great guns right now? I mean, the current resurgence in rig count in the United States is faster than at any other period of recovery in history since they've been keeping these rig counts. So, that's a big market concern, is will U.S. increases in production counterbalance these cuts by OPEC? So there's a million unknowns, Chris, but the bottom line is that Oil supply and oil markets are a big super tanker, and you just don't turn a super tanker quickly. It takes time to make those kinds of adjustments. And so in the most optimistic case, you know, I'd say just for round numbers, we're a year away from having oil prices be what they need to be to encourage the investment to somehow soften the blow of higher oil prices in the future. That gets you to, well, what's the global economy capable of affording? Can the global economy afford $70 a barrel? And that's another question, and I have some serious doubts as to how much it can afford that.
Right, right. Lots of moving pieces, but again, oil is the lifeblood of all economic activity, and we know that China is now the largest importer, and their consumption statistics continue to go up, and the OPEC internal consumption statistics continue to go up. So, you know, I'm still sticking to this idea that somewhere out there we've got the flip of this story, which is we're not oversupplied, but at least in terms of export oil, we're undersupplied on the world. And again, people need to be reminded of this. The United States is not energy independent with respect to oil. We import a lot, 6, 7, 8 million barrels a day, depending on the week, month, and time of year we're talking about. So we're still a heavy importer. China's coming on. India's coming on. Everybody's using it. And again, that stuff we didn't find in 2014, 15, 16, that's a date we've got in the future. And we don't know what that looks like yet either. But you put all this together, people really ought to be paying attention to this, because this is really, I think, one of the biggest stories out there, and you know, hard to predict because lots of moving pieces, but it certainly is fascinating. And Art, I want to thank you for the diligent data-based way that you go at this. And you know, there's a lot of PR out there, a lot of spin, and I know people want to be optimistic, and it's good to you know, have lots of hope for the future, but it's even better to be realistic and let the data tell you what it needs to tell you. So I could keep going here, but in the interest of time, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and point people to artberman.com and check all that out. Art, is there any other place or way people can follow you? You giving any talks?
I give a lot of talks, but you'll find what you need on my website. And I'll just close by saying, yeah, Chris, sometimes people you know, ask me, well, gee, your message seems a little bit gloomy to me. And I say, wow, I don't feel that way. I understand why you do. But as someone who wants to live in the world, much less if you're an investor, I'd rather have my eyes open going into this thing. I'd rather see things clearly rather than see things the way that my bias wants them to be. And hopefully the people who listen to this share that view.
Well, absolutely. So as a final closing investment thought, I'm kind of interested in these services companies that have been really beaten down with an upturn in oil prices. Of course, their prospects would seem to me to be amongst the brightest to participate in that turn. Is that fair? Or are they already, you know, where are we in the service company cycle right now, do you think?
Well, I think things have to be looking up for the service companies, and if you look at the big ones, certainly you know, Schlumberger and Baker Hughes, I say they're beaten down, and they are, but you know, they still got positive cash flow. Now Halliburton is another story, and they don't look so good. But the real issue is that there is a deficit of frac crews. That's the piece of the industry that really was neglected during the downturn. And so the demand out there for frac crews is huge. And so I, as an investor, I would look at the companies that are really gearing up to hire people, and more importantly, to get their fracking equipment fleets back up to speed. Those are the guys that are going to make the money.
Well, fantastic. Art, thank you so much for that. Thank you for your time today. And we'll hopefully talk again in the future.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris.